The Mutter Museum in Philadelphia is well known for its unusual collection of 19th century medical oddities, instruments, and specimens collected by Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter. Our guest, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, first visited the museum when she was on a fourth grade school trip. She was so inspired that she later wrote a screenplay called Mutter that won several awards. And now her book, Dr. Mutter's Marvels, A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine, has just been published. It's about how this pioneering and eccentric Philadelphia surgeon embraced anesthesia when others scoffed it and chose to work with patients with severe deformities, often shunned and called monsters by doctors and the public. We are joined by Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz. She grew up here in Philadelphia. She's a poet. She lives now in Austin, Texas. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times talking about one of my favorite people.
I am so thrilled to be here. It's a dream come true, honestly.
Well, that's great. Let's begin with Dr. Mutter's name. And First of all, there are so many ways you can pronounce it. He was not born with an umlaut. Right. He added it later. How do you say his name?
I say Mutter. He was born Tom Mutter. And Virginia in 1811, but when he got his medical degree at University of Pennsylvania, which just celebrated its 250th birthday yesterday as the oldest medical school in the country, he went to Paris to study new types of surgery and radical types of surgery, because that, he believed, was his calling in life. And when he returned from Paris, he had an umlaut, and he decided from that point on, you will call me Dr. Mutter. And so I honor him by pronouncing it that way, but I do get corrected a lot by people who say in the South, it's called Mutter.
It's Mutter, but here in Philadelphia, it's Mutter. Does that tell us something about him? Because I know he was a snappy dresser. He cared about his appearance and perhaps cared about details. So just how to pronounce his name, giving it this kind of special foreign look.
Absolutely. He was orphaned at a very young age. His little brother died, then his mother, then his father. He got sent to live with his grandmother. The grandmother died. And he was an orphan ward. And I think he largely felt ignored, neglected. He was an orphan ward in a giant plantation of the Carter family, of the famous King Carter family. And I think from a very young age, he wanted to be seen as exceptional. And it started when he was in grade school. He was extraordinarily bright and ambitious, and he wanted better clothes than his guardian would allow him to pay for. So he created this scam, which I think kind of sets up who he would be as a person, which is he would buy very expensive clothes, charge it to the school, and then work hard to earn scholarships to pay off his enormous clothing bills. And it worked for a while, but not forever.
So why did he care so much about his appearance, do you think?
I think in the beginning it was to cover up the fact that he came from such dire circumstances. But I think as this is just a personal philosophy on this, I think that he did it because he was working with people who didn't have the choice to stand out, right? So if he was performing a surgery on a man with a giant tumor hanging off of his face, and he comes in a pink suit to perform the surgery, he can tell that man, you're not the only one they're looking at. You know, like, he became an oddity, a self-created oddity, and I think it maybe helped the other people who didn't have that choice to feel better around him.
As you said, he was an orphan. He grew up in Virginia, and basically his whole family died. Do you think there was something about this early loss of family that made him want to be a doctor?
Absolutely. This was in the, he was born in 1811, so we're talking about the early half of the 19th century. And medicine was a real wild, wild west, as you read about in the book. You did not need a medical degree to practice medicine. You could apprentice or not apprentice. Bleeding, purging, leeching, all very common. And I think he understood, as someone who himself was physically weak, I mean, he didn't escape the physical ailments that his parents and brother succumbed to. He just outlived them. And he would die a very early age. And so I think he knew how he wanted to be treated as a patient and used those philosophies when he became a doctor. I mean, he had a really humanistic vision of medicine. He really believed the purpose of medicine was to alleviate human suffering, which was very different than the other doctors of that time period, who understandably sort of had a vision of, I'm going to fix this problem, and if it causes you pain, so be it. You'd rather be in pain than dead. But he said, we don't have to make that choice.
Well, you get the feeling, too, that going into the hospital meant you would be dead, because, there wasn't the germ theory.
Exactly.
Germ theory. People were not wearing gloves.
Right. Or washing their hands. Or
washing their hands.
And it's more than just that. It's more that they didn't know. One of my favorite lines that I discovered in my research was, the stiffer the frock with blood, the prouder the busy surgeon. Which means when you came to get surgery done, you would want to see your surgeon covered in the viscera of his other patients, because it was proof that he was a trusted surgeon. And they, obviously, we don't think about that at that time period. But that's how far they took it. It wasn't just, we're not going to wash our hands. I'm literally going to be covered in the blood of other patients when I perform on you, and that will be a comfort to you.
I'm trying to imagine the ad for that. What that would look like.
Right on the septa. Covered in blood. I'm the best.
You also describe early 19th century Philadelphia. This was, of course, yes, a big city, a right, crowded city for its time. And as you say here, an easy place to die. I mean, it was just filled, I guess, with infections, a lot of poverty, alcoholism.
I mean, another thing that was not known in that time period was the communicability of diseases. So they didn't understand how diseases spread from person to person. And so you would have entire neighborhoods decimated by a disease like cholera or yellow fever. There's some really great sections in Dr. Mutter's Marvels talking about the city's responses to these epidemics and how terrible they were. They had a yellow fever epidemic that was so bad that the city government shut down. They just let people die in the streets. And then once it got so bad, they just annexed a circus ground and brought all of the dying people to a circus to die there. But I mean, you know, you have to understand, like, they just did not have the benefits that we had. You could not imagine the leap in innovation and technology that happened the last half of the 19th century, which is not when he worked. We were talking earlier about The Nick. You know, if the
TV
doctors,
show.
The TV show, The Nick, if the doctors in during Mutter's time period had the innovations that are happening in the Nick, they would think it was gifts from heaven. And it's being presented to us as some sort of backwards horror show.
But do you think the fact that this was such a unhealthy place for people to live in the beginning of the 19th century led to some of these innovations? Of course, it was the city that was the home to the first medical school.
Right.
So on the one hand,
right,
you've got all this horribleness. On the other hand, you've got the development of a medical system.
Exactly. University of Pennsylvania, first medical school, Jefferson Medical College, which is now Thomas Jefferson University, followed a while later, and they were battling each other to be seen as the best. But we were really the medical Athens of America. That was what we were called. And it's true, we had an ample amount of different kinds of diseases, different kind of injuries. And Mutter himself specialized in radical surgery on the severely deformed in a time before anesthesia. And these people were largely considered monsters, even medically, in the same way that idiot was considered a medical term. And so they were hidden in back rooms, particularly women. It was a shame to their family. They're dependent on men at that time period. So to be deformed was a death sentence, even if it didn't kill you. And that these people would come out of the darkness to be treated by someone and know that they're going to have a dramatic, painful surgery while they're awake and people are holding them down on a table really speaks to the type of doctor that Mutter was, right, how much patients trusted him and how successful he was for any number of reasons.
He went to Paris to study for a while. In fact, that seemed to be one of the pivotal points in his life. He saw doctors there working with some of these people with severe deformities.
Yeah, plastic surgery, which I think in modern times, we tend to think of cosmetic surgeries, nose jobs, and lip enhancements. But plastic literally means malleable. And so it was more reconstructive surgery that he was learning when you had a deformity such as a nose that was cut off or a cleft palate. To use the body itself to heal those was a very new concept. And Mutter had innovations such as the Mutter flap that are still being used today because he was that forward-thinking. But it was at its very earliest stages in Paris, and he was one of three doctors to bring it to America. And he was perhaps the most popular in terms of specifically working on the severely deformed. And there's over 80 pictures throughout the book of Dr. Mutter's Marvels, and all of the woodcuts of the patients are all of Mutter's actual patients. So when you see something really horrible in the book, know that that was a person who came into his office and said, you know, I found a lot of letters in my research where the patients wrote, I would rather die on your surgery table than continue to live one more day living as I do. And these were the men and women that he helped transform.
There was a patient in Paris that really stayed with him. She had
a horn growing from her head. Madame Dimash, who, if you've ever visited the Mooner Museum, that was one of the things that stuck with me when I was a kid. The woman with the horn growing from the head, the soap lady, the giant colon. Those are parts of my childhood that other cities
don't get. Yes.
And that's a part of Mooter's original collection. Mooter purchased that wax model, because it was a symbol of the type of surgeries that he wanted to do. And people talk about the specimens at the Mooter Museum. That was one of the reasons I started researching the book, because I grew up here in Philly, and when I went to school in New York, people would go, "Have you heard of this museum?" It's like, yeah, we all go there as kids. It's like, why do they have it? What's the purpose? And I realized, I don't know if Mooter was a man, was a family, was an acronym. I knew nothing about it. And that's when I first went into the archives to say, what was the story behind it? And you learn that these specimens, which, we sort of view as shock value, are teaching tools and are still being used today. It's still important material to this very day.
You mentioned the Mooter flap. Describe that for our listeners.
So when you are missing a huge chunk of skin, let's say your nose is cut off, we have the idea of grafting, taking skin and putting it over there. But the earliest days of grafting would just fail. First of all, there was not germ theory. So no one washed their hands. The skin that they would use to cut out would get massively infected, black, and fall off, and the person would die of infection. But Mooter discovered that if you keep a portion of the skin attached to the human body and just twist it around to cover up the hole. So if you, let's say, cut an approximate shape of a nose from the skin of your forehead, not too deep to cause damage, but just enough to revert it around, and then put it over your nose, that it would, as long as it was detached to the base, blood would flow through it, and it would become accepted by the human body. And he would do that on enormous portions of skin. One of his most frequent surgeries was enormously burned people, and specifically women who particularly were susceptible to horrible burns on their face and neck because they wore very restrictive clothing that was highly flammable and cooked over open flames. And all you would need to create essentially like a tunnel of flames going up your bodice was just one spark to hit your petticoats. And these women would be horribly deformed, unable to blink their eyes, unable to close their mouths. And he would take the enormous chunk of skin from their back and switch it around to reconstruct their face.
But we're talking about living tissue then, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And that was really the turning point in a way, because the tissue was still living.
It was that, but it was also the fact that he believed in sepsis theory. He believed that you needed to have clean hands, clean tools, and a clean operating. So other people may have tried the surgery and failed, not because the actual surgery was flawed, but because they did not create an environment where it wasn't going to turn blackened and septic and kill the patient.
Well, we are talking about Dr. Thomas Dent Mooter in this hour of Radio Times. And our guest, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, has written a book about Mooter. It's called Dr. Mooter's Marvels. And the Mooter Museum in Philadelphia is well-known, well-loved, one of my favorite museums in the city. We're talking about Dr. Mooter's contribution to our understanding of medicine. And we're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Much more about Dr. Mooter after this short break. We'll be right back.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. The actual NASA-recorded sound of a deep space black hole can be heard when Fringe Arts presents The Four Seasons Restaurant, an unflinching drama by Italy's renowned director Romeo Castellucci. Compelling soundscapes and awe-inspiring visuals propel this theatrical look at the impact of absence on the human psyche. Presented now as part of the 2014 Fringe Festival. More at fringearts.com. That's fringearts.com.
Next time in Studio 360, I'll talk with style maven and Broadway star Tavi Gevinson. She's only 18, but she's been field tested by junior high.
In seventh grade, like, for as much as it sometimes stung to be kind of bullied, it was also kind of like, yeah, bring it up.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. So how much do animals and humans really have in common?
We find that animals not only behave the way we do, they may think the way we do too sometimes. Through modern technology like MRI, we see that brain areas in animals may be activated in ways that mirror our own.
Your dog can get jealous. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, our guest is Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, and she's got a new book. It's called Dr. Mutter's Marvels, a true tale of intrigue and innovation at the dawn of modern medicine. And we've been talking about Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, who studied here in Philadelphia, worked in Philadelphia as well, and many of the specimens and medical instruments that he used are housed at the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You're right. And I should say that our guest is also a poet. In fact, has 6 books of poetry.
Yes.
In fact, is there some kind of a connection between being a poet and being interested in Dr. Mutter, for you anyway?
I will say that a lot of my research and time writing the book was supported by poetry fellowships. So I'm grateful
that
for
helps.
Poetry to have given me spaces to write this book. But to me, you know, being a poet means looking at something and pulling meaning out of it, taking one moment or one exchange or one time and saying this reflects who I am as a person or what this time period is like. And that was very helpful when researching Mutter. And I hope that shows in the book that you sort of use medicine and the life of this man to kind of have a larger conversation about what America was like at this time period and the struggles we still have in patient care and in doctor-patient relations and how we treat ourselves.
Was it a challenge, though, to write many, many words? As opposed to poetry?
Right. No, it's true. I'm a big nerd. I went to Central High School here in Philadelphia.
Yay.
Academic team captain. So doing this sort of research was hugely gratifying. Yeah, you could stick me in an archive and I will be happy as a lab in water. And so it wasn't, you know, pulling it all together and telling a story this important to me was difficult, but only because I wanted to do honor to the subject matter. I think he was a tremendous man, and there's no biography about him that's ever been published. So to me, I wanted to make sure that I did him justice and did it right.
You say that he loved the daringness, these are your words, daringness of surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we know surgeries at that time were a form of theater.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, Mutter grew up not, you know, with struggling with resources financially. And at that time period, you know, who you were, who you knew, the families you burned into really helped you in your career. Even in medicine, you know, if you were wealthy, then you could treat wealthy families because you knew them. Surgery, however, he knew and recognized early was something that if you were exceptional, people will come to you and you just have to prove yourself. So he wanted to make sure at a very early stage in his career that people saw him doing the surgeries that he considered to be important, innovative, and controversial. Unfortunately, you know, some of that worked against him. The Philadelphia community at that time believed you needed to go, you know, through certain channels and appeal to certain people in order to rise up the ranks. And he just blew through convention and upset people left and right, was a name dropper, acted like all of the surgeons in Paris were his friends, and alienated people early in his career. But his work, you know, would test out, and people slowly came to realize that something that they had sort of mocked as this frivolous, ambitious dandy was actually right about many of the things that they had mocked him for.
And could people actually see the surgeries? You know, there weren't obviously right. The television cameras or anything like that. So you've got this amphitheater. You've got doctors huddled over a body somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
How much did they actually get to see?
Well, there was public demonstrations when they were trying to attract people to their medical schools. Jefferson and Penn would set up public demonstrations, and some of them went terribly because they would try ambitious. One of the stories in the book was they were removing an upper jaw, again, with a person who was not anesthesia'd, and it was so disturbing that the students in the audience vomited and fainted in their seats. That's the research that I came up with. I started cackling in the archive.
Know.
Right, and I was like, no one's going to find this funny but me. But, he had surgical lectures that were much more smaller for his actual class at Jefferson. And that was one of the innovations that Jefferson created prior to that to get a medical degree, which was very new. Medical schools were very new, and you didn't need it to practice, but it was a great calling card. It was just doctors lecturing one way. They never asked the students questions. The students couldn't ask them questions. And with no bodies, maybe some illustrations, Jefferson said, if we're doing a surgery clinic, if we're doing teaching surgery, we need a clinic, and they need to see these surgeries performed live. And that was an innovation created by Dr. McClellan, who helped found Jefferson, and Mutter continued in that tradition. And so many of the surgeries that are talked about in the book are described as not only from Mutter's textbook, but from students watching in the audience going, this is amazing. I've never seen anything like this. So it was really wild doing the research and finding all of these primary source materials that no one has touched in 150 years that tell the story that seems to have been forgotten, unfortunately, but I'm happy to be bringing it out.
Well, and he also seemed to have an innovative approach to teaching at the time, which was there was more back and forth. It wasn't just a professor or doctor standing and lecturing for, 90 minutes or more.
Right.
But he really did engage with his
which
students.
Was shocking and uncomfortable for students who were sort of used to sort of taking notes and being talked to. He would ask questions, and at first no one thought that they thought it was rhetorical, and he would be waiting. But he had a more Socratic method of teaching, which was unheard of, and he introduced the concept of quizzing. Which is, I'm going to teach you a bunch of material, and now that I've done teaching you, I'm going to ask you questions, and you need to answer them right, or I'm going to it seems so logical now, but that had not been done before. And so he would take things he learned from both as a patient and then as a student, and then as a surgeon, and tried to create an experience that really taught his philosophies to a generation of students. In the end of the book, you'll see, how those played out in the lives of the amazing doctors who would go on and take what they learned from Mutter and do things like, create the concept of triage or found the company that would later become Bristol-Myers Squibb. Like, all of these American institutions and things we associate with medicine to some extent had a background with Mutter.
And did that come from Paris, or was this just sort of how he approached surgery and being a doctor? These were his own ideas?
These were, he learned things for sure in Europe, which was, far ahead of America during that time period. But he also put his own spin on it. When we talk about patient engagement, bringing a humanist element, that was 100% Mutter. The surgeons that he admired the most were very callous. I mean, one of the surgeons that he, Duprien, that he viewed as a god, would drag the people he was going to do surgery on into the amphitheater by their nose, like just hooked it into their nostrils and pulled them in as if they were livestock. And again, that sounds horrible, and it is horrible.
It is horrible.
But, you have to understand the mind of a surgeon back then, which is, these people need to have some of these surgeries done. Let's say a gangrenous leg. That person's going to die if you don't cut it off, but how do you convince them that? And then once they say, I believe you can cut it off, you're going to have to hold them down. People are going to have to hold them down, and they're going to be screaming, stop, I don't want to do this, and you just have to ignore them. So you have to imagine that builds within a surgeon a certain sense of detachment. I can't
literally
get attached to a patient because I know I'm going to be causing this pain, and I don't need to be swayed from the work I know I need to do.
Right.
And of course, that played out much farther out than it needed to be. And Mutter was someone who believed strongly in pre- and post-operative care, again, not really heard of in that time period, and having a humanist vision, making the patient a part of the process of surgery.
Is there any way to know how he felt about the pain that he and other surgeons were inflicting on patients, even as they were trying to cure them or heal them?
Well, he it's really funny. The only medical textbook that he ever produced was co-written by Robert Liston, who was sort of a famous surgeon in London, the fastest knife in the West, they'd call him. And before he'd perform surgeries, he would yell to his students, time me, boys, before like hacking off a leg. But he spent a lot of time talking about the work he would do to help desensitize patients. He did things like cleft palate surgeries, where you're literally hooking the tops of your mouth together and sewing them up. Now, you can imagine that's extremely painful and might make you feel very nauseous. So he would spend days, if not weeks, massaging the face, touching the tools to it, getting them used to the process so that when it happened, the patient understood what was happening under every step of the way and could tolerate it better and hopefully lessen the pain. Who knows if it did?
Right.
But at the very least, it it brought the patient and surgeon closer together so that they weren't struggling against each other. And then after the surgery, he instituted recovery rooms, which actually were turned down by Jefferson. They said, no, we don't need it. We're going to, after you're done with these very delicate surgeries, they have to be put into a carriage. And then, I mean, I'm from Philly. Everyone's been down those cobblestone streets. That's difficult enough with rubber tires. I can't imagine wooden tires, wooden wheels, and a horse just destroying all of this, and he insisted on it. So both before and after, he wanted to make sure there was pain management and care towards the patient, which again, 100% Mutter.
You also say that Mutter was ambidextrous.
Yeah,
I mean, equally good with both hands, right, which I guess meant he was also a pretty quick surgeon.
Right, and that was spoken a lot by his colleagues and his students, who felt very intimidated by him to be able to do the work as quickly as he did, because he was equally good with both hands. And many doctors at that time period claimed to be ambidextrous, but I remember one doctor saying, that usually means they have two left hands, meaning they're equally bad at both. But Mutter was fantastic. Fantastic. And it was actually during the later part of his life, you know, he thrilled in being seen as sort of a wonder kind and a genius who cannot be replicated. But as he got iller later in his life, he realized, I don't need to be telling my students that they'll never reach my heights. I want them to be taking the patients who won't be treated unless they believe they can treat them after my death. So he gave a lot of speeches about saying, like, you know, you don't need to be a genius. You just need to work hard, which I think, again, was a shift in thought.
Well, we are talking about Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, and our guest is Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, and she's written a book about Mutter called Dr. Mutter's Marvels. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Any questions or comments, do join our conversation. I want to pick up on something you said about women, because you had a really fascinating chapter in the book about literally how their clothing became a kind of prison for them. They would sort of pour themselves into corsets and tie themselves up, and then became a potential fire hazard. Right. There they are cooking in front of a stove or maybe even an open fire. The clothes catch fire. They cannot get out of their clothing.
Yes.
And get burned.
Right, right. And then again, you know, the how women were seen during that time period, they would get these horrible facial burns and the family would just hide them. They wouldn't even let a doctor see them because they didn't want the stigma of having a deformed woman in their family. And so these women wouldn't have treatment for years and years and years. And in general, the way that women were asked to behave, both in dress and in person, really harmed them in terms of seeking medical care. One of the more controversial statements that Mutter had was he realized that when women came to him with tumors on the breast, of the breast, so breast cancer, that by the time they came to him, because modesty would say you never show your breast to anyone but your husband, by the time they came to him, it was too late. He knew that the cancer had spread. So they would ask him to remove the tumor, but he knew, I can do this, but you're still going to die anyway. And your last months are going to be in a tremendous amount of pain, trying to heal this enormous wound. You're not going to be able to hold your children. You're not going to be able to sit up. So he taught, you know, unless it's big enough that it's, you know, you can't, it's, the woman needs to have it removed, don't perform the surgery. Mm-hmm. You know, just allow her to live the last months of her life. So palliative care, almost, in a way that was fulfilling and she could spend it with her family. And people thought he was a monster for believing that. But he innately understood surgery doesn't solve everything. It can solve many things, but we shouldn't go to the knife as the solution when logic tells you what's going to alleviate her suffering. And surgery in that case would have added to it.
It's an interesting time in that there was the development over time of germ theory. Mm-hmm. But I guess until that time, the idea is things could become infected through air, right? That was the theory at the time.
There was many theories of how. But, I mean, one of the things that was really interesting, and I apologize to anyone eating a bagel right now because we're kind of talking about sort of gross stuff, but pus from surgeries or any sort of wound was so common, it was expected. They thought that every wound came with pus. And so you had laudable pus that you were trying to get, and then, like, stinking, Icarus, horrible pus that you're trying to avoid. It didn't occur to them that you could clean a wound and treat it in such a way that you wouldn't get infected. It was beyond their concept because they had never come to encounter that. Yeah. And that's what's so interesting about this time period is that it's not so much that these men were dumb or weren't seeing the signs. You're talking about an entire history that led up to this point where things change and they just didn't realize it. One of the interesting stories that came out of here is the discovery of anesthesia.
Exactly.
And, Mutter was the first one to perform anesthesia here in Philadelphia shortly after it was introduced to the Medical Society in Boston. And right afterwards, it was banned in Philadelphia hospitals for 7 years. And people think like, oh my gosh, why would they do that? But it's because in order for anesthesia to really work, you needed several things to line up that had not lined up at that time period. It's medicine. You know, again, we think of medicine as, oh, you buy it at a pharmacist, it's standardized, every jar of aspirin is going to treat me the same. That was not the case back then. So when you were given ether, you had no idea really what the makeup was going to be. So
or the dosage, right?
Right. So sometimes you would follow the instructions, would be too little, the person would wake up mid-surgery, it'd be too much, you'd risk killing them. So you had that factor. And in fact, Mutter struggles with that, inspired E.R. Squibb, who later created standardized ether and then founded Bristol-Myers Squibb. And then you had doctors whose entire careers were based on having patients awake on the table who thought it was losing a sense, like a sixth sense, to be able to say, to know when to stop cutting. When does this stop being painful? Okay, that's where I cut. And that when the person passes out, that's when you stop surgery. How do you know when they're bleeding out if they're not there to tell you? It was very foreign to them. And then lastly was germ theory. You know, they realized that without cleaning your hands and tools, the people would die at the same rate, whether it was ether surgery or a surgery where they're awake, because it wasn't the surgery that was killing them. It was the infection. And that would last, you know, Mutter died right before the Civil War. But in the Civil War, twice as many soldiers died from disease and infection than they did on the battlefield, because that was that big of a problem.
Was this a conservative medical community when Mutter was working?
It was to a certain extent. I mean, we were vanguards compared to the rest of the country for sure, but it was a bravado-based bunch. You know, you'll read in Dr. Mutter's Marvels about the early days of these medical schools where people were literally brawling in faculty. I'm from Philly, so I know we're a bunch of brawlers. But brawling in faculties, they would go to each other's lectures and heckle people mid-surgery. So it was very contentious. And one of the main sort of the antagonist of the book, Mutter's main nemesis, was a fellow faculty member named Charles D. Miggs, and his career was based on his bravado. He presented his ideas in an infallible way, and anyone who contradicted them, he would insult them and take them down into press, and he never acknowledged that so many of his ideas were wrong. And he, to understand why Miggs was so popular, is to understand why Mutter struggled so much. And so I'm really happy to include both of their stories, because I think when you read about Mutter, his ideas seem so obvious, but you needed to understand the community that he existed in, why it was such a struggle to have it be heard.
And we're almost up on a break here, but would you say it was a clash of egos between Miggs and Mutter? I mean, Mutter
absolutely
had a big ego, too.
Of course. He used to match his suit to his horse to his carriage when he rode around, so certainly he was a vain man. But he strongly believed that that his thoughts were right, but his idea was, I'm going to do this through action. He didn't. After, in the early part of career, he would engage in those sort of public debates and try to win approval through publications. But as soon as the anesthesia was discovered, which was shortly after that medical text was published and essentially made the medical text he spent years working on obsolete in his mind, he thought, no more of that. I'm going to just do the surgeries and teach my students, and they'll know.
We are talking about Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter. And again, our guest is Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, and she's written a book about him called Dr. Mutter's Marvels, subtitled A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation at the Dawn of Modern Medicine. Yes, we're talking about things like pus, but we're also talking about other things as well. And so do stay with us. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. We'll be right back.
Fringe Arts supports WHYY. The actual NASA-recorded sound of a deep space black hole can be heard when Fringe Arts presents The Four Seasons Restaurant, an unflinching drama by Italy's renowned director Romeo Castellucci. Compelling soundscapes and awe-inspiring visuals propel this theatrical look at the impact of absence on the human psyche. Presented now as part of the 2014 Fringe Festival. More at FringeArts.com. That's FringeArts.com.
Next time in Studio 360, I'll talk with style maven and Broadway star Tavi Gevinson. She's only 18, but she's been field tested. by junior high.
In seventh grade, like, for as much as it sometimes stung to be kind of bullied, it was also kind of like, yeah, bring it up.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. So how much do animals and humans really have in common?
We find that animals not only behave the way we do, they may think the way we do too sometimes. Through modern technology like MRI, we see that brain areas in animals may be activated in ways that mirror our own.
Your dog can get jealous. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The Mutter Museum, with its fascinating displays of 19th century anatomical specimens and models and medical instruments, has been housed in the College of Physicians in Philadelphia for more than 100 years now. And this is a one-of-a-kind museum, and it's a testament to the genius and eccentricities of Dr. Thomas Dent Mutter, who studied, worked, and lived here in Philadelphia. And again, our guest, Kristen O'Keefe Aptowitz, has written a book about Mutter's life and his various contributions to surgery. Her book is called Dr. Mutter's Marvels. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You mentioned this earlier, but I just sort of marvel at the fact that this was a man who was very consumed with his own appearance.
Mm-hmm.
He commissioned a portrait by Thomas Sully.
Yes.
He, as you say, matched his carriage and his suits and everything
right.
like that. And so interested in deformities and other people's appearances.
Right.
And it's such an interesting, almost startling contrast.
Yeah, juxtaposition. Again, I think that to a certain extent, you know, he did that purposefully. I mean, I think in the beginning he did it to draw attention to himself, but I think it was the idea of making himself stand out purposefully and receive the criticism that might come with standing out, so that he could, you know, make the people who didn't have that choice feel a little better, especially when you're talking about a surgical lecture where you're taking someone who has literally been hidden in a back room and not seen anyone but their family and thrust them into a room full of strangers and perhaps be made naked in order to perform some surgeries, and to say, hey, you're not the only one they're going to be looking at. I'm looking pretty good today, too.
Well, but he obviously cared about appearance.
Yes, absolutely.
And people's, I guess, judgments about appearance as well.
Well, I think that he wanted to look the way he wanted to look. And so if it, you know, Philadelphia had a Quaker past, a lot of the people wore blacks and beiges and browns, and he was in fantastically colored pink suits and blue suits. Even the lecture tickets that you would use to gain access to his lectures, all of his contemporaries had brown or gray tickets, and his were bright pink with gold lettering. So he wanted to be noticed. And but I think he did it knowing that it risked making people upset with him, and he did it anyway. He just wanted to live the life he wanted to live.
Did he become a wealthy man? As you said, he was born into a family with some wealth, but became an orphan.
Right. His family's estate was tied up in legal fees, so he didn't really see any of it. The family that took him in, the Carter family, was tremendously rich and was, you know, sporadically generous with him, and other times would just leave him out to dry. He did have enough money to live the life he wanted to, but when he fought to have essentially what became Jefferson Hospital built, and then once he realized the amount of need in the community for the surgeries that he did, he made it year-round. So it wasn't just during the school year. He did that work year-round. And so he didn't enjoy the money any more than the clothing he bought and the house that he lived in, and he would throw parties with ice cream and oysters. But he didn't live the life of a wealthy man. He was really fixated on his work.
There's a story you tell in here about a woman who died. Actually, her name was Eliza Sowers. I hope
yes.
I'm correct pronouncing her name correctly. Tell us her story.
So one of the main people I follow in the book is this Charles D. Miggs, who was the chair of obstetrics and was an ideological and even physical opposite of Mutter. He was the 13th, you know, like a 10th child of 11. His father was the 13th child of 13. He was robust and healthy, the oldest faculty member hired at Jefferson when Mutter was the youngest and sickly and didn't have any children and didn't have any family. And he had a very brutish way of dealing with women and taught his students to deal with women very brutishly. One of the favorite quotes that I have of him is he said that women's skulls are too small for intellect, but just the right size for love, meaning, you know, as a compliment. And I remember transcribing that and thinking, oh dear, if you knew who was telling your story, I don't think that you would want to say that. And he sort of viewed women as being lesser than men, and that you should, you know, have a game plan that you execute regardless of what they say to you. And to a certain extent, you have to understand that time period. You're talking about women who were amazingly modest. They wouldn't let themselves be examined except through a blanket. And so when he says stuff like, there was a woman who said, "You can't examine me. I would rather die than be examined by you." He said, "Well, what woman wants, God wants to," and left, basically like, "Well, then I guess you're going to die." But, it, you know, he felt that was necessary to get the women to do what he knew they needed to have happen. Elizabeth Sowers was a case that he was called in to examine. She was a woman who had gotten pregnant. She was a working class woman. She had just upped her stage in life by becoming a maid and needed to get rid of, end her pregnancy. During that time period, have an abortion. But the idea of abortion back then was different, was changing. And this case was one of the instrumental cases that changed it. Back then, even Miggs, who was known as the preeminent obstetrician of that time, didn't understand how conception happened, didn't understand when, you know, the development of a fetus. They literally believed in something called the quickening, which is that there's an unanimated mass that grows in a woman's body, and then the hand of God comes down and gives it its mortal soul, and that's when it starts to move. So until you felt a baby move, it was not considered a baby. And so having an abortion prior to that time period was not illegal. But that case changed it because this woman tried to do remedies of various kinds and was finally by her employer passed to someone who purported to be a physician. Again, this is an unregulated time period.
Sure.
And it's a horror story of what happened to this poor woman, where she was just moved from boarding house to boarding house, suffering extraordinarily painful because this man operated with unwashed tools. And her case transformed abortion law in America. It was one of three really important cases. And Miggs was called to testify, and he essentially testified that he didn't know, you know, how conception happened, yeah. But that he thought abortion was wrong nonetheless, and he was such an important
man.
She died. Right.
She died.
And the doctor said, oh, she wasn't pregnant. She just had bad, you know, indigestion, and they actually had to have people come in and examine her. Looking at dead bodies was not really something that was looked upon lightly back then. It wasn't as common doing autopsies as it was. So to do that, to take that extra step was fairly new.
You've mentioned the fact, and it was true that Mutter was perhaps frail, maybe even sickly for a lot of his life.
Yes, and he also had hereditary gout. So his hands were really affected, gout being a swelling up of the joints. And his hands were his tools to perform surgeries. Unfortunately, they did not know the causes of gout and a lot of the food that were the staples of doctors' lives. So you're talking about beer,
yeah,
and oysters,
yeah,
were consumed in large amounts, would trigger the gout. He had no idea. And
it's so painful, too.
It's extraordinarily painful. And you'd have these people, deformed, helpless people, come to him, and he couldn't perform their surgeries. He relied a lot on Pancoast, who was the chair of anatomy, to help him with those surgeries. He suffered greatly throughout his life.
He also seems susceptible to respiratory problems.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. He always had weakened lungs. You know, it's sort of interesting, the inability for the human body back then to fight off disease and infection. They didn't have antibiotics. Early in your life really affected every aspect of your life. People always talk about how people were much shorter back then, and they say, oh, it's because of nutrition. But a large part of that is you would have a kid get yellow fever, and all of the body's ability to grow during that period would be sapped up by fighting these diseases. So if you're talking about him getting a pulmonary condition, a tuberculosis, let's say, early in maybe his tween ages, so while the rest of his body was growing, his lungs were fighting it, he would always have those deformed lungs for the rest of his life. So a lot of the stuff that he struggled with during his younger years would cause the problems in his older years. And he died at the age of 47, which was early for that time period, for his type of his station in life.
Absolutely. And where did he die?
He left Jefferson after 15 years. The faculty that he had come on, Jefferson had fired their whole faculty, which were brawling instigators, and hired what they considered to be the faculty they would want to represent American medicine. And they lasted for 15 years until Mutter, the youngest, had to leave because of illness. He went to Paris to try to get healed. And again, another example of, you know, him learning these lessons. He was told by them, there's no getting better. There's only relieving your pain. And he said, if I'm going to die, I want to die in America. And I want my collection of specimens to be housed in some place that respects it. And so his last thing was to start the Mutter Museum collection with the College of Physicians of Philadelphia. And as soon as he signed off on the contracts, he went to the South, where he was from, and died just a few months later.
And was it a hard sell to find someone who would take these specimens?
Yeah, he had an enormous collection of specimens. And
where did he house them, or where did he keep them?
He had some at Jefferson and some at his private collection at home. And he was always, you know, I would find letters from him in my research where he would be writing a fellow colleague, and then it would be a postscript that says, if you ever come across an unusual facial tumor or a deformed bone, please let me know, as I might be interested in taking it home. So he was always on the lookout to learn more about the human body, both to teach his students, but also himself. I think that he saw things like conjoined twins who died shortly after birth and said, if I was there for their birth, what would I have done? How could I have helped that situation? But it was an enormous collection, and he was really specific. He wanted to be housed in a fireproof building, and it had to be built within 4 years. He knew how things dragged on in bureaucracy. And Jefferson, he offered it to them first. They turned it down. Huh. But the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, the country's oldest medical society, decided to take it on, and they built it just before the Civil War, just in time to live to Mutter's legacy. And it's open to the public. People should come by. It's fantastic. And their YouTube channel, if you're watching this not near Philadelphia, equally creepy and gross, you should definitely check that out as well. But it's I did about half my research there and half of it at Jefferson. It's a magical place.
Well, as you wrote, and as I said, your first trip there was in
fourth grade.
Fourth grade, yes. Trip to the Mutter Museum.
Yeah.
I mean, were you wowed as what, a 10-year-old?
Right. You know, the Mutter Museum is the most popular museum, a science museum in America for the ages of 18 to 35, because it does what people tell you not to do. If you ever saw some of these people in public, you'd be, don't look at that person. You know, like, don't look. And instead, it takes all these things you're not supposed to look at and invites you to come closer and explain, why did this happen? How do you treat it? If this happened to you, what would it be like? And as a kid, that just lit me up inside. And clearly, two and a half decades later, I've got a book coming out. So clearly it made an impact.
Well, you did write a screenplay called Mutter, You Are a Poet. Have you done a poem?
About Mutter?
Mutter?
I've not done a poem about Mutter, but I have written a lot about sort of the weird stuff that I've come up on my research. I'm a big history nut, and so when examining this time period, you just come up with strange stories, and that's definitely made it into the poetry. But I wanted to make sure that everything I loved about Mutter stayed in the book. I didn't want to tease it out with poetry before the book was ready.
He was married during his lifetime.
He was, to Mary Alsop, who was from a Connecticut family that was very well off, but they did not have any children, and it's never been explained why.
Ah. So how should we think of Dr. Mutter? I mean, in terms of his various contributions. And is he recognized, you think, to the degree that he deserves?
I talk to doctors. I've obviously spoken to a lot of doctors. And they know that they knew Mutter Flap. They know that they didn't realize it was attached to the museum. Some of them know the museum. But I think that the last half of his life, when he knew that his life was going to be cut short, he's focused so much energy on getting his knowledge and his philosophies, you know, his humanist philosophies, to treat patients like equal, to have transparency, to have them be a part of the process and make choices for themselves. He wanted to spread that to his students. So a lot of the ways that he could have made himself stand out and be seen as irreplaceable and be someone who was decades ahead of his time, he purposefully dissolved that into his students so that his work could live on when he didn't. So in some ways, you know, I'm really happy to be sharing his story because I think it's an important one, and it has just been forgotten by history except for the museum, which is an amazing legacy to have left. But I'm happy to be the one to tell the story of how that museum came to be and the man behind it.
Are you done with Dr. Mutter?
Never, never. I'm gonna.
There's more here to mine.
I just love his time period, and I would love to. You know, there has been some interest in maybe making a film or a television series that tells this story. So I would love to continue to spread the gospel of this man. I think it's still stuff we're struggling with today. We still struggle with how to take care of populations medically, who deserves medical care, who deserves to be making decisions about health, women's health, you know, especially. These are things we're still dealing with in the 21st century. And so I hope that this book starts a lot of conversation and about those topics that you feel like this happened 150 years ago. We're still dealing with it today.
Well, in certain ways, we're still dealing with the Civil War today.
Yes.
But you have a chapter here, a section here, about his views about race,
right,
and slavery and equality. And again, he's very forward-thinking on a lot of this,
right,
stuff.
And I mean, you know, you have to imagine that time period. I mean, we live in a politicized time period, too. I mean, I like to use the example of gay marriage. You know, there's a tipping point now where I feel like supporting gay marriage, which I was the president of the Straight and Gay Alliance at Central High School, so I've always been in support of it. It's being less, let's say, political suicide to do it. But before, you would have politicians who privately believed it was okay, but publicly, in order to appeal to their constituents, needed to say something different. When it came to race relations in medicine, the country was on the brink of civil war, and the institutions would say, please do not address this debate. We're not going to talk about, we're just going to work exclusively with white patients, and we're not going to say biologically, which is evident to anyone who's an anatomist, biologically these are two are the same. We can't make that statement because it is too politically charged. And Philadelphia was the gateway to the South. Half the medical students at the school were Southerners, and in fact,
including Mutter himself
and Miggs as well. So it was a political statement, but Mutter, again, he believed in science, and in his own textbook, he has an African-American patient presented without commentary as this is how you treat a patient, which in my mind was a quiet revolutionary act that he did.
Well, on that note, my thanks to you, Kristen O'Keefe Aptewitz, for joining us
today.
Thank
you so much. This is a real thrill.
Well, a thrill to have you with us and also to talk about Dr. Mutter. And again, our guest is the author of a new book called Dr. Mutter's Marvels, and it's subtitled A True Tale of Intrigue and Innovation in the Dawn of Modern Medicine. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can download podcasts of the show. Also, you can check us out on facebook.com/whyyradiotimes. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter at @whyyradiotimes. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.